Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me in studio today, I have Chris Stasonis, VP of Engineering from Lola. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What was your kind of origin story? How did you initially get interested in technology?
Interestingly enough, company-wide meeting the other day, we had a question for the entire executive team. What did you want to be when you grew up? I think it was the only person that got to say, I did it. I've wanted to write software since before I knew it was software. Grew up in the 80s. From the minute I got my first Nintendo, the original NES, thought, wow, these games are really cool. I want to make these. I didn't know what that meant at the time. And I lucked out in the fact that my father, while not a software engineer, really worked around the tech industry kind of in a different segment. So I had really early access to computers. Kids in the 80s didn't really get this. Commodore 64, got to do my first programming on that. Had early access to like 286s, 386s through my teenage years, was connecting to BBSs, building my own computers from very early on. Started putting together websites from the minute I had AOL access before the internet was super ubiquitous.
Do you still have an AOL.com email?
I do not.
The mark of shame in the 90s?
Yeah, but it's a mark of tenure, I think. So.
Yes. Now that you're at Lola Travel, for those folks who aren't familiar, can you tell us a bit about the company and what you're doing there?
Yeah, so Lola Travel has been around for a couple of years. We're really in the business of making business travel software. I think our tagline is business travel software that doesn't suck. If you've been in a business, particularly in a larger enterprise, and you use things that are there for corporate travel and booking corporate travel, they tend to be kind of kludgy. They tend to be not as robust as, you know, a user booking travel on Expedia or Kayak or the kind of consumer-grade experiences. So our feeling is to marry the kind of consumer-grade travel experience with all the other tools that are needed to manage corporate travel systems, the accounting systems, the policies, things like that. So I was brought on in March of 2019, so just coming up on a year there now. And we had just taken a Series C, and the Series C was really a recognition that we had found this product market fit. We had kind of started to see some traction, and we really wanted to step on the gas. So it was brought in to really grow the engineering team, all that goes along with that. And so that's kind of what I spent my last 9-10 months doing. Had some pretty good success there. We've grown the team from about 13 people at the beginning of the year, just on engineering, to about 45 today. And so that's presented some interesting challenges for sure.
Everyone can tell you that hiring good software engineers is hard. I'm sure you'd agree.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean? Like, what does it mean on a weekly basis? What are you doing? And how are you kind of coaching the team into trying to ramp that quickly, trying to absorb people quickly? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things I've taken away because I've had to do this kind of growth once or twice before. And every time I've talked to someone and say, hey, we grew this team this fast, they're like, what was your secret? The secret is there is no secret. It's just hard work and it takes a lot of time. So that's the first thing I try to instill in people is, right, you're going to spend a lot of hours doing this. There were weeks where I would interview 5, 6, 7 people in addition to doing phone screens. I would sink personally 10, 12 hours into just interviewing people. So I think my first piece of advice for people that are getting into this is plan accordingly. You're going to spend a lot of time doing this. It's not going to be quick. You're going to learn a lot along the way, but it is really time consuming. I think the other thing is if you're growing this fast, you really want to invest in the systems that make hiring and onboarding people work really well, right? You're going to be doing a lot of interviewing. Make sure your process is locked down. Make sure the people that are interviewing know what they're going into that room to find out. Make sure that you have a really good system for evaluating, you know, how are you going to make a decision on whether this person is a good fit for your team or not? And then once they come on board, make sure that the systems that actually get them up to speed are first-class citizens. When you're a much smaller team, it's easy to just say, oh, we'll just bring them on. They'll figure things out. Everyone will help them out. When you're hiring 10 people a month, that's an incredible time sink. And getting onboarding wrong, in my opinion, is a huge risk. It's a huge time waste, but it's also a risk in losing good people that you've just brought someone in. They know nobody. They took a huge risk to leave their position in a known good place. And now you're bringing them into this new environment. Make them feel welcome and, importantly, productive as fast as possible. Because I think all the good software engineers you really want to get, they want to be productive. Make that easy for them.
Did you guys do anything in particular as far as onboarding? Was there documentation? I know that's always the fight. Like, it's hard to get people to make the documentation. It's even harder to get them to update it.
Yeah, that is the big push. Some people had already kind of stepped up and started writing some documentation. We made sure that we carved out time for that. We fixed a few of the kind of core underlying, call it onboarding roadblocks that kept people from getting up to speed really quickly. So we just made sure we carved out some time to fix some of that tech debt. And then usually I will sit down with everybody on their first day for half an hour just to kind of meet and greet. but leave them with a message of, you know, follow the scouting rule, leave this better than you found it. There are going to be things in our documentation that are missing because, you know, we've been building the software for a while. We just kind of intrinsically know things and we don't know what to write down. So when you find one of those things, stop, fix the documentation right then and there, feel empowered to make this better, make it easier for the next person that's going to come behind you. And like I said, leave it better than you found it. Incrementally, you just get this process to be much, much better. Ideally, my goal would be to have someone be able to commit a very simple piece of code on their first day. We're not quite there. I think we're on day two right now, which is still, in my mind, pretty darn good.
Anywhere in week one is pretty good from an industry standard.
Yeah. And a lot of day one is consumed by HR onboarding and things like that. So I'm going to consider this pretty good.
Very nice. What is the format of the docs? Do you guys use a wiki, Confluence, plain old Word docs?
Effectively a wiki. We're using Tetra. We don't have Confluence in place. We have some things in Google Docs. And then we also, in addition to the documentation, whenever someone's getting onboarded, they are assigned effectively a buddy that's with them for the first week. Their sole responsibility is to make sure that this new person is feeling welcome and gets up to speed, does simple things like show them where the bathroom is, tell them where everyone goes to lunch, things like that, just to really get them to be part of the team. And as part of that, if you are assigned as an onboarding buddy for a person, we're making sure we account for that in the capacity for what we're planning to actually get done that week. We expect the to not be nearly as productive as you were. So kind of negate your capacity for that week or those 2 weeks to make sure that we make that onboarding a first-class citizen that we're accounting time for.
Coming from being a hands-on engineer, moving into a management role, how do you know, you know, when it's time? Some people feel like I need to do that in order to make my next salary jump. How do you know whether or not it might be a good fit? How has it worked out for you? What are the lessons learned you would tell someone that's at that juncture in their career?
I like to say that I kind of fell into management, which is something that has worked out pretty well for me, but I would also wish it on nobody. I've promoted a few people to manager in my current job and several over the course of my career. And really, it's about having a really good conversation about what changes when you become a manager and making sure that someone is really on board, and also driving home the message that your only way to get more salary, more authority and influence is not necessarily through management. There's a lot of things that I believe leadership can come from outside of management, that leadership does not have to come with a management title. So making sure that those pathways are really clear to make sure if you want to come into management, there's opportunities, but make sure you understand what you're getting into and you're getting into it for the right reasons. Because management, in my mind, the thing that wasn't clear to me when I first started is management is a completely different job. You're not getting promoted. You're laterally moving into this new job that you have no experience in. And I think that's the important first lesson, right, is you're moving to this new job. And if I'm promoting you to that job, I expect you to be bad at it for a while. We're making an investment in you, but you should understand that you're going to trip up. You're not going to be nearly as good at this as you want to when you first start, because there's a lot of new skills to learn. The biggest piece I try and drive home, right, is when you're a software engineer, your deliverable is really straightforward, right? You're delivering code, you're delivering tests, you're completing tasks. When you're a manager, that's gone. Your management responsibility is now to deliver a team that can do all of that for you. Yes, you may still write some code, but ultimately, when I'm looking at my managers, I'm saying the thing I need from you is to put together a team to accomplish these tasks the business needs to get done. And that's a very different job than just delivering tickets. And it's hard to go from a mindset where you're like, oh, I'm just going to go and write code. I'm going to go heads down. I can just pour more time into this and I will get this task done, to a position where your deliverables are a little bit less tangible. They can't necessarily just be solved by sinking more time into it. And really, you're trying to get more work done through other people than just by doing it yourself. So that can be, I think, a really hard mental shift for a lot of people that I've seen go through this transition.
There's a change in skill set for sure, from, like you said, banging out code, fixing bugs, building features, closing tickets, to how do I motivate people? How do I attract people to the team? How do I keep them engaged? Was there ever a time you had to deliver kind of a tough message, or, you know, had a challenge in one of the first times you were dealing with that people capacity of the job?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a couple. One that comes to mind is actually a little bit more recent, where I had an employee who just seemed like they were kind of on the downhill slump. They were not super engaged. It was really hard to get a lot of them. Their projects were delaying. And this is going to be kind of a strange management story, in the fact that the end result was this person actually ended up leaving the company. But I think it was the way it all happened was really good. I got to sit down with this person and say, look, you don't seem motivated. You don't seem interested. What's going on? Talk to me. Like, is there something else outside of work, or is it just work? And he's like, you know, it's not getting me excited anymore. And I'm like, all right, well, do you think that's something we can fix? Is there other work going on at this company that you think would excite you? We can move you around. Like, you'd be a hit to move you off of this team, but sure, we'll find another spot for you, because we want you to be a happy employee. And what really turned out, he's like, you know, it's just, I don't feel the mission of this company anymore. It's just not really exciting me, but I don't know what to do with that. And was like, you know, I think you actually do know what to do with that. I think you know what the answer is. You're just kind of afraid to admit it yet, which is, it might be time for you to go. It might be time for you to leave and find what will make you happy. We're in a, particularly within software, we're in a market that effectively has 100% employment. There is very little reason for a software engineer to be in a position that they aren't motivated by, they're not happy in. So they should be seeking out those places that actually let them feel excited, make them want to get out of bed in the morning and come to work. And if your current job isn't that, maybe it's time to look and see what else is there. But as part of this, the thing that went really well with this employee that I would say, even though they left the company, I see it as a success. We were able to really talk about what this person wanted, what they needed, even if that thing meant it's time for you to leave the company. Having that kind of open, frank conversation with an employee can be really hard. Ultimately, you're going to lose a team member, and that's going to hurt. Your team's going to suffer from it. You're going to all of a sudden have to start hiring again, and that's more work for you. But making that decision that this is the right thing for the employee, ultimately, it is the right thing for the team as well. And being able to have those frank conversations can be really hard to learn to do that, but it's also incredibly valuable. So I take a lot away from that experience just because I think it was, even though it's not the outcome we ultimately want, it is a really good outcome for that employee and for the team, I think.
Yeah, when I was growing up, I think I witnessed the death of the Alliance, the lifetime employment, the IBM 25-year gold watch type of thing in the early 90s. It seemed like that was really when it was starting to fall apart. And it seems like a lot of folks' tenure at jobs gone from high number of years in most cases to 2-3 years a lot of times. How do you know when it's time to leave? What are some of the things, you know, that employee mentioned maybe not feeling the mission? What other signs do you think there are?
There's been a couple of times in my career where I've actually bought a book for employees that a subtle hint that maybe they need to think about this by a guy named Michael Lopp called Being Geek. And the whole first section of the book is really about getting that itch to leave, about what do you look for when it's time to find the next gig. And I think there's a lot of interesting things in there, but really what it comes down to, right, is your job, we're not in lifetime employment anymore. You're going to be here for 2-4 years, probably. That's when I hire an employee, that's kind of my expectation. Sure, there's going to be some people that last a lot longer, but really I'm looking at like, what do we want to accomplish in the next 2-3 years? And I think that's a two-way conversation, right? When I'm looking at from the business perspective, what value is this person going to bring to the company in the next 2-3 years? The employee should be thinking the same thing. What do I hope to get out of this? Aside from a paycheck, right? I'm assuming everyone's going to leave if they're not getting paid, but outside of a paycheck, what else do you hope to get out of it? And really look at your job as more than a job, right? Your job should be preparing you for what you ultimately want to do. And to me, the tipping point is when your job is no longer preparing you to do that. Some people are going to have very specific missions to be on. I can say for a long time, I've been kind of on this track where I've wanted to end up in a position where I'm at right now. So making sure my job is moving me in that direction has been super important, and making sure that you're learning the things you need to get there. So my first piece of advice here is when you get into a new job, or even periodically while you're at your current job, evaluate where do you hope to be? What do you hope to get? And if the job is no longer aligned with that, it's probably time to start considering leaving. At the same time, it might also be the time to sit down with your manager and say, this is what I'm hoping to get. Can you help me? And hopefully they can. Hopefully they can help you get that in your current job. I think one of the other signs to leave is when your manager says no. If your manager isn't interested in helping advance your career, that's probably a bad sign. And it's probably somewhere you don't want to stay for too long. But I try to encourage people, have these really frank conversations with your manager. Hopefully you've got a manager that's really good, that is open to having these conversations, that is open to discussing the fact that, you know, one day you're not going to be here. I'm pretty open with my employees. Like, look, I don't expect you to be here forever. I want to make sure that I'm helping you move towards your next step. Let's figure out what that is. If you read the book, The Alliance, which is, I'm going to forget all the authors, but Reid Hoffman was one of them, talks about really having kind of a plan or a duty around your time at a company, what the company hopes to get out of it, what you hope to get out of it, and make sure you're moving in the right direction. And as that you kind of reach the end of that plan, it triggers this conversation to say, okay, so this is what we hope to get out of this deal in 2 years. We're coming up to the end of that project. I think we've accomplished it. What's my next step? Is my next step another tour, another contract, another set of responsibilities with this company, or is it time to consider leaving? And I feel like that framework really gives you a good opportunity to have these really frank conversations with your manager about, is this where the next steps for me as an employee? Where do I fit into this company?
I think some engineers are a little bit reticent to talk to managers. I think a lot of them have, I haven't really seen management done well. I'm a little bit worried about this and broaching it. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've probably all been in a position that we've had bad management before. Hopefully you're in a place now, particularly in software engineering, right? We all understand the market. Managers, employees all know that, you know, you could stand outside a sell station with a sign that says, I want to write some code and you'll have a job in 20 minutes. Managers have to accept that. So hopefully you can have these discussions to make sure you are really aligned with what you're looking to get out of a company with your boss, because they have to accept reality. You can leave whenever you want. I think that's kind of one of the premises as of the alliance too, was if I start having these conversations with my employees, it will feel like I'm giving them permission to leave. It's never your permission to give. Like, people can leave whenever they want. I hope you're in a position that you've got a good manager that you can have these conversations. If you're not, that's probably a sign that it's time to leave. And what I mean by a good manager, right, is while yes, your manager is looking out for the company, they should also be looking out for your best interests. And hopefully, almost always, those two things align, but a good manager will be able to actually have a conversation with you about when they don't. You know, your personal interests are no longer directly aligned with the company, and what do we do about that? The thing I would say to encourage people to kind of have these more frank conversations, if you were coming to interview for me and I said, hey, I'd love to do some reference checks, and you turn around and said, you can talk to my current boss, that would be a huge check in the pro column. I would really look at that as, hey, this is someone who's really mature, who's had really good conversations with their existing boss, has formed a really good relationship, and is really thoughtful about this. That's a huge mark in your favor if you can pull that off. And I think while it's really uncomfortable to go talk to your boss and say, hey, it might be time for me to transition, I think it's less awkward than you think it would be. As someone who's managed people for a long time, I think it's a conversation I'm always open to. And I hope people are getting into a position where they have managers that are also open to that as well.
I know some engineers are a little bit reticent to do it because they're like, well, what if I get let go while I'm doing my job search? And then I have a period of like not making money while I'm doing this. And there's a little bit of secrecy that you tend to lean towards.
Definitely. I think there's definitely points in the market where this would be even more awkward, right? When I got first out of college, early 2000s, the market was still kind of pretty poor for software engineers. It took me a couple months to find a job. If you were a software engineer, you're not going to have a problem finding a job. You're not going to worry where your next meal is coming from, almost guaranteed. It may not be the job you necessarily want, but you'll get a job pretty quickly.
Now, you mentioned when we chatted on the phone a little while ago that you always try to put yourself out of a job. What do you mean by that? And what do you do it?
If we go back to what I said earlier, a job of a manager is really to deliver the team that gets the job done. And if you do that really well, you build a team that is really empowered and can do things, can get this job done. Ultimately, you kind of start working yourself out of a job. My goal is to empower my management team to not make myself a roadblock to, and also to be looking to kind of train up my replacement in general, because I'm a firm believer in having a solid succession plan. So making sure that the things that I'm the only one that can do, how do I start working that down to my team? How do I make sure that other people can take on this responsibility? How do I make sure that my team is empowered to make decisions without me? And this is great for putting myself out of a job. It's also great for being able to take a vacation and not worry about things falling apart. Like, your end goal is to make your team super self-sufficient. And if you follow that to its logical conclusion, you're really bored at work all of a sudden because you've got nothing to do. I haven't got there yet, but I've got a lot of good people on my team. I've been in places where I've had really strong teams that worked with me. I have at least gotten to a point where I felt very comfortable about leaving. Yes, they were going to have to fill my seat when I left, but the team wasn't going to collapse behind me. And I think, you know, most people don't want to leave a disaster in their wake. Most people aren't leaving jobs because they're bitter. Definitely happens sometimes, but mostly you don't want to burn a bridge when you're walking out the door. So getting your team into a position that it will survive your absence is really important.
My dad told me never to talk to strangers, or to recruiters, or to strange recruiters.
It's so exciting when the website gives zero information about the job I am applying for.
You take one 3-month sabbatical, and all of a sudden, you're unhirable.
You're not allowed to say it, but you're looking for someone younger than me. Joke's on you, I'm 11 years old!
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com. Find a better way today. Syrinx Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserve, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry.
I think that's another skill of management that a lot of folks don't talk about is becoming a systems builder. Like taking, all right, I can try to take everything on myself and be the single point of failure slash critical path on everything. But if you try to figure out what you're doing and make a system out of it and delegate and get other people doing it, and then if you get all the plates spinning to the point where you can step back for a second and say, hey, it works on its own. I can go away for a long weekend or a week and it's not all chaos and everyone can make decisions and get stuff done.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I think I'm just getting to the point where I'm starting to hand those plates off to other people. For the first 10 months at Lola, I was a hiring manager for every single role on my team. And that takes up a lot of time. You're in a lot of discussions. You're in every single interview. Finally, at a point where I'm like, all right, the team has been interviewing for long enough that they've got it down pretty pat. We've got some managers in place who I have a lot of faith in their ability to make a hiring decision. And I can say, all right, this one's not mine. I'm going to give this role over to this person. They can be the hiring manager. They can take me out of some of these things. And I think generally as a manager, you're kind of hit these peaks and valleys where you take on a lot of stuff and then you find yourself really overwhelmed and you have to stop and say, do I need to be doing all these things? First of all, do all these things need to be done at all? And if they do, are there things I can give to other people? Can I delegate down? Not because I'm trying to be lazy and trying to just not have anything to do, but it's your responsibility to raise up the next generation to take your responsibility and also just make yourself less critical path than you already are. So I'm kind of at the peak of one of those waves right now, and I'm trying to claw back to get a little bit more sanity and hand off some of this stuff to my team. But recognizing that and recognize when you have people that can actually take on these responsibilities is really important as a manager. Can feel really awkward to let go of things, particularly when you're first getting into management. Likely you ended up there because you were really good at your job and you knew everything. As a software engineer, you knew all the parts of the code. You could jump on anything and fix it. And now you're stepping back and saying, I've got to let someone else be really good at this. And that's going to make me less good at it. And that can feel really awkward, but it's also really empowering. And if you don't do it, it's a quick path to burnout, right? You take everything on yourself. You will inevitably just not be able to handle it anymore.
And I don't think you really need to be concerned that if you start building a system and taking many of these tasks and empowering other people to do them and all the plates are spinning on their own, that you're ever going to get to zero tasks.
Oh, yeah.
There will always be something.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I said, I've never actually gotten to the point where I have no more work, but it's kind of a philosophy that just empowers informs how I make some decisions about what I'm going to do. And I think the other thing that's really kind of jumping back to things I wish I knew as a manager, right? When I look at my managers, I judge them by the success of their team, not by the success of that individual. So if you aren't doing everything, but you've got a team that's accomplishing all those things, if you've got a team that you've leveled up a bunch of people and they're taking on new things and they're becoming much better software engineers and delivering things faster, that's your success. Your success is the team that is getting more done. It's not you being the expert on everything that team is doing. I think it can feel really awkward when your boss comes up to you and says, hey, what's going on with this? And you say, I actually don't know because I have a team that I trust to do that. I'll go find out. But you feel initially like you have to know everything. And the truth is you don't. You can't know everything forever. So the bigger team you end up with, the larger the scope of that knowledge is, and you're just going to run out of space to store it all.
I think it's not just software engineering or software team management either. I've seen sole practitioners who are like a lawyer or accountant go out, start their practice, and initially like they're the ones like doing the job and doing the billing and doing the marketing and doing the sales and doing the everything.
Yeah.
And it doesn't scale.
Yeah.
It is a recipe for burnout. You got to figure out, even if it's a part-time resource or a contractor or a vendor or someone, how to take some of those pieces and find someone you can trust to do them.
Yeah, there is no way you can be an expert at everything. I think you're right in that. I speak a lot from engineering-centric point of view, but I think it applies to a lot of skill sets. And like you said, if you're the sole proprietor that's doing all of those things, there's no way you're good at every single one of them. And you can probably get away with it for a while, but at some point you grow past it and you need to bring on people who are really good at that one thing and let them do that.
At the beginning of Syrinx, guy got to do a little bit of everything, HR, sales, recruiting, accounting. And I wanted to do it for a little bit to get a feel for A, what was involved, B, what did doing a good job at it mean, and C, what do I need to know in order to pick someone good to do that job? But then, yeah, find someone that's very good at it and have them handle it better than I can, preferably.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you touched on one of the other really hard parts of management. How do you hire someone who's better at the job that you're hiring for than you've ever been? Example I'll put out right now, I'm about to open up a position for a manager of DevOps. I'm not a DevOps engineer. This is really at Lola. It's been the first time I've had DevOps formally reporting into me. So how do I make sure that I hire someone who's really good at this job that I don't know that well? And I think there's a lot of ways you can tackle that, but that can be a really daunting task as a manager. Or like you said, you have to dabble in it a little bit to be like, how do I hire a good HR manager when I'm not an HR person? That can be a challenge for sure.
So we've covered a lot of topics that we will put links to in our show notes. And you can find those show notes at underserved.libsyn.com. That's underserved.libsyn.com. We're also looking for our audience to participate, provide feedback, and we're looking for future guests on Underserved. If you're interested in any of those, our email is underserved@syrinx.com. That's underserved@syrinx.com. So when you're not busy at work, you have some hobbies that you're interested in. I think you fly some small planes.
I do fly some small planes. Earlier when I talked about getting up in front of the company and saying what I wanted to be when I was a kid, I only told you half the story. I got to get up and say, you know, I wanted to write software and I wanted to fly planes. And now I do both. So I have loved planes since I was a little kid. I don't think I'm alone in that. I just kept going and decided at some point that I really wanted to learn to fly. And luckily, my now wife, then girlfriend, her stepfather owned a small plane and had his instructor's license. So I said,
oh, wow,
this is serendipity. Let's go do this. So have been flying for about 13 or 14 years now. And it's honestly my way to check out because, well, half the time I can't get my email on the plane. and secondly, it is all consuming. It's hard to be in there and focus on things other than flying the plane, paying attention to what's going on. It's a large mental task that I find very gratifying, but it also takes me out of my normal day-to-day, which has been great. And you get to go some cool places. And, you know, thankfully my kids are usually amenable to me saying, hey, kids, want to go fly to Maine for breakfast? They tend to be on board for that. So get out once or twice a month and go do that.
That's cool. When you're learning, like, I think I remember the progression is like you fly during like good weather and then you have to learn instruments.
Yep.
Like, how long does that all take?
I got my fair weather flying private pilot certificate, like I said, about 13 or 14 years ago. Had to give up flying or chose to give up flying for a little while after my first child was born. And then really got back into it about 6 years ago. And just over a year ago decided, you know, I want to take the next step and get to do weather flying, get to fly in the clouds. So got an instrument rating just the beginning of 2019. Got to use it almost right away. Took a trip down to Florida by myself, or flew with my brother. Got into some challenging weather where, you know, take off, you're in the clouds, 30 seconds later, you don't see the ground for a couple hours and you just hope you're doing the right thing. It's really gratifying to be able to do it. It's also something that, honestly, iPads have made a lot simpler. Carry an iPad on the plane. What used to be a huge stack of books and charts now fits in the palm of my hand. It is way more easy to use than following along on these paper charts and drawing lines with pencils. Now, you just like when you're using Google Maps, you can drag and draw a line and you can make the plane go where you want it to, which makes things far simpler. But yeah.
The iPad has all the maps already on it and it's just using the GPS to update where you are. So it doesn't need a network connection or anything.
Yep. No network connection. Actually, the equipment in the panel of the plane will link to your iPad so it can push certain information like weather and also traffic so you can see other planes flying in the sky on your iPad, which is
sick. Just don't let the battery die.
Don't let the battery die. Carry a spare, lots of extra cables. Yeah.
N+1 everything.
Yes. Everything in the plane is redundant. The iPad is extra situational awareness, we call it, but it is totally redundant to everything else that's already there. So if it dies, we get along, it would just be a little bit more complicated.
Now, we also, when we chatted on the phone, you mentioned an unusual common denominator we're finding more and more. You raise chickens?
Yeah. Several years ago, someone was interviewed while I was working. I had just joined Fitbit and they said, and our new director of engineering lives on a farm. That's not quite true. I live on about 2 acres in North Andover and we fairly well in the woods. And several years ago, we decided that we wanted to get chickens. Yes, it'd be nice to get eggs, but also we have a huge tick problem and chickens love to eat ticks. So we said, let's get some. And we've had them for 6-7 years or so. Actually, the fun backstory there is they were illegal in my town until my wife was determined to get the bylaws changed. So she went to town meeting, got a new zoning law passed. And the next day we had chickens in our backyard, which was
nice,
which was good. Yeah.
Is that the right to farm thing that I see?
So right to farm kicks in after you have 5 acres. The state kind of says if you have 5 acres, you override a bunch of zoning laws around keeping and having farm animals. Under that, the town can still do things. So we basically put a clause into the zoning laws, or I should say she put a clause into the zoning laws that allowed people with less than 2 acres to keep a certain number of chickens. So we've had them ever since, and they're kind of great to have around. We let them free range pretty frequently, which is sometimes terrifying because we have every predator that wants to eat a chicken in our backyard. We've got foxes. I chased one out of the backyard a couple days ago. We have owls and fisher cats and raccoons and all the things that want to eat chickens are kicking around, but we'll be eating our backyard and the chickens will be running around and they will beg worse than dogs. They'll eat anything. So they will come over to the table and jump up on the table and try and steal food from us. So they're endless entertainment, frankly.
Oh, nice. Now, have you tried to apply technology at all to your chicken keeping?
Yeah. So my oldest son has recently got into programming sometime last summer. He's like, so I'm learning Python. And I'm like, great. How are you doing that? So we ended up getting a Code Academy license and everything. And he's been kind of chugging along in that for about 6-7 months or so and really into it. Totally remember the phase of learning that you could make computers do what you want to. I'm just being obsessed about it. He's totally in that phase. And I see a lot of myself in that. So this past Christmas, we ended up getting him a Raspberry Pi and a bunch of electrical components to go with it, with the end goal of building a way too complicated automatic chicken door. So chickens are relatively smart. They go and put themselves to bed every night. So we will generally let them run free. And then sometime around sunset, they'll just go put themselves into bed. And we are too lazy to go out, particularly when it's rainy or cold, to close the door. And so we are building a system that will raise and lower a door with a Raspberry Pi. I guess we're standing on the shoulders of giants. This is not the first people to do it. There's actually a GitHub project that does most of this, but it was a good opportunity for me to work with my son on this. We've still got a lot of work to do. It's the first time I've ever worked with like the electronics side of Raspberry Pis. I've had a Raspberry Pi before, but really it was just, I'm going to install some software on it and mess around with it. This time we're actually plugging into the IO ports, hooking up a motor controller, hooking up a bunch of hall sensors to do magnets sensing so you know when the doors are open and closed, and programming against that, which has been a lot of fun. I know how to solder, but start teaching my son how to solder things. And we also got a 3D printer for Christmas. So we're hoping that once we have all these janky wires hanging around, at some point we can print a couple of things to house the motor and house these sensors and make it look way more polished than a chicken door ever should. And then he has high hopes of hooking it up to Swift app for our iPhones so we can open and close the door on demand. And my end goal too is hooking up a camera to it as well. If I'm going to have a computer in my chicken coop, I might as well have a camera in there so I can see if all the chickens are in there. So streaming that over to our phones and hooking up text messaging and all that fun stuff. Way overcomplicated for what it needs to be, but it's been a lot of fun to figure out. And I am now kicking myself because I built the chicken coop myself, and then I trenched our backyard for power and water, ran conduit under our yard. And when I was doing it, I was thinking, I should really put a network cable in here. I didn't do it, and now I don't think I can. So hopefully our wireless signal is strong enough in our backyard, but I'm really wishing I had put that Ethernet cable under the ground to run out there. But hindsight's 2020.
When in doubt, Cat 6 everywhere.
I'm certainly not about to dig up my backyard again to do this because it was a backbreaking labor. But
yeah, you might be able to get away with some like directional antennas on each side.
Yeah, it's not too far out of our house, so I think worst case, just put a hotspot in a window close to the chicken coop and we'll be fine, but you know.
With the magnets and everything, it almost sounds like a garage door where it can sense if it's up or down and...
Yeah, it's a little bit like that. Effectively, there is a, you know, a motor with a string that winds up and pulls the door up and down, and there's two magnet sensors that say when it hits the top, when it hits the bottom, so you know to stop the motor or start the motor, and which position the door is in and all that fun stuff. Definitely a little bit out of my comfort zone with these. I've never done it before. I haven't touched anything like a breadboard since I was in college 20 years ago, so, but it's fun.
That's cool.
And thankfully, most of the components are really cheap, so we're inevitably going to smoke a few of them, and we can just buy another one for a quarter.
Yeah. Now, folks can't see, but in studio, Chris has the Remarkable, which is a tablet that looks kind of like a Kindle, but you can write on it, and it can recognize your handwriting, turn it into text, and then ship it by email. What do you think of it? How is it in the trenches?
So I'm still kind of new to it. I've had it for a couple of weeks. I really enjoy the writing experience. I think it's there's something tactile about writing, and there's something about writing that makes things stick in my memory, at least more than typing it. And I'm a really distractible person. I'm the person sitting at my computer the minute I see a Slack notification, the minute I see a little notification that I got an email, I have to go look at it. So the point of me buying this device was really to give me a distraction-free device to haul around to my one-on-ones, to keep to-do lists, things like that, with the added bonus of it syncing up to the cloud. So I can get these notes on my phone, on my desktop, wherever I need them, because I'm also really good about leaving things at work and then working from home and being like, oh, I've got that note written down, but it's 30 miles away. So this kind of bridges some of that gap. The writing experience is really great, really pretty seamless. It doubles as an e-reader, which is kind of nice. I just took it on a trip I had last week. It's a pretty decent reading experience once you get it. The only downside I have to it from a reading experience, it would replace my Kindle if they could make the syncing of books to it as seamless as a Kindle. If I could not carry a Kindle and just carry this one thing, I'd be super happy. So overall, like, jury's still out on whether this is permanently a part of my workflow. I like it so far. I don't love it enough yet, but it's definitely kind of an interesting twist on having a tablet. I've got a lot of people at work that are just like, why didn't you just get an iPad? They have iPad Pros and they carry the pencil around with them. It's really about the distraction for me, and this is pretty good about keeping me distraction free. Yeah, so we'll see how it goes.
It feels like I do the Stone Age version. I write in an actual notebook and then take pictures of it and upload those to Evernote. And that'll do the handwriting recognition for indexing and searchability, but it won't give me a copy of what I've written out that I could then slap into a Word doc or something like that. I feel like they should partner or acquire one way or the other, and then it would be a pretty cool, seamless experience.
I can't search my notes on here, which is a downside. So you kind of have to have some organization that you can follow. I think the other, and this I think is a problem with my Kindle as well. You know, when you get a book, you can highlight in the book and say, hey, I want to remember this. And I was, before I got on the show, I was flipping through something and I'm like, oh, there's a couple things in here I need to take note of. There's no way to say, hey, show me everything I've highlighted in this book. You have to go page through and find where you put this. So if they could fix that feature for me, fix the syncing of books to it, or just be a little, have more support for things like Kindle or other ebook formats, it would be absolutely a killer device for me. It's not quite there yet.
Way back in episode one, I mentioned that I disabled all my notifications on my phone except for the kids like team app that we use. And I've gotten a bunch of feedback from people like, I don't know how you live like that. Like, how do you not have text messages show up? How do you not have email give you a notification? And I'm like, it'll be there when I look. It's bad enough even without those on. Sometimes I'll open my phone, I'll mean to send an email, I'll see that there's a 12 in my inbox. I'll start reading those and be like, what did I want to send an email about? Like, you just got to get that task out of your head before you start looking at all this stuff that's being thrown at you.
Yeah, I just finished another book called Make Time, which is all about this, right? About removing distraction to make yourself more productive. Not necessarily just because you want to get more work done, but to free yourself up to do the things that you want to do. And that could be work. It could also be, I really want to be freed to go spend some time with my kids. And I'm not the only parent who's super guilty of being like, oh, I'm hanging out with my kids. And you pull your phone out of your pocket and 10 minutes later, you're like, I don't even know what's happened for the last 10 minutes. So they actually went to the drastic step of removing not only notifications, but take email off your phone, take Slack off your phone, keep basically nothing on your home screen, take off all of the social media apps. It's just, you know, keep your calendar in there because it's a functional thing. Keep maps in there, but remove the stuff that is, I think they use the term infinity pool. Like, you can just keep going down into it and there's no end. I can't bring myself to do that yet.
That's hard.
Yeah. I still need a game on my phone once in a while to kill a little bit of time or take a brain break, but I respect people that have the willpower to do that.
That's a tough one. Well, folks, if you have gotten out of the infinity pool and toweled off and done this to your device, please let us know via the email address we mentioned before, underserved@syrinx.com. That's underserved@syrinx.com. All right, Chris, well, thank you very much for coming down today. We appreciate you making it over to the studio to record with us. You've shared a lot of interesting stuff. I'm sure folks will be digging into the show notes to follow up on.
Definitely a lot of fun coming in. Appreciate spending the time.
All right. Thank you very much. And we'll talk to you all again soon on the next episode of Underserved.